Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Erica Bernheim. Erica Bernheim was born in New Jersey and grew up in Ohio and Italy. She received her MFA from the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop and her PhD from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Since 2008, she has been an assistant professor of English at Florida Southern College, where she teaches creative writing and directs the honors program. Her new book, entitled The Mimic Sea, was published in 2012 by 42 Miles Press. Hi, Erica, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me, Jan.
Oh, sure. And congratulations again on your book.
Thank you.
It's really great. And the listeners can't see it, but it's a really beautiful cover with this sort of deep blue. You have to see it, but it's really nice.
What I like are the spaces where the blue kind of gets a little bit thinner, almost as if something's going to break through the surface. I think 42 Miles Press does an amazing job. I may be biased, but I think they do a really beautiful job with their books.
Yeah,
they've been wonderful
really nice.
To work with. Thank you.
Okay, so you're going to start with some poems from your book?
Yes, I'm going to start with a poem called Virgil Moon. Virgil Moon. I'm willing to bet that greasy 20 stuck to the bottom of your empty file cabinet. It's never me you think of when you try to shoot yourself onto the ceilings of your apartment. Your thoughts lie somewhere in the sink you call your Amazon basin, soapy home to blue Julies and banded Lisas and frozen Charlottes, their spiny tongues making short work of crumpled toothpaste tubes and tiny spoons, and the questionable ghost of your mother's lover who kicked your dog across state lines, showing little more remorse than a teenage shoplifter. Last night I dreamt you took out the trash, flipped beautiful lean burgers on an outdoor grill. I can see you talking to the plumber, convincing him to lose himself down the slimmest of pipes in search of what we've discarded and still cannot move past. Without you, I dream of blood in my stomach, my breath shrinking when jewelry salesmen beckon enormous topazes in my direction, and I am always tempted to move towards that city which has yet to discover neon. It is my turn to bask in the limelight, my turn to basco, the lime's light and this glass so heavy. Pretending we have been pensive, all bets are often decided by the sea star stomach flowing out its mouth, straight to the point that food, nothing, gets wasted, save a few starfish, one backed against the wall, tube feet straining to make sense of a truck that refuses to shift into reverse and is still going nowhere fast. A bad phrase, a neck in the creek, a tiny piece of skin determined not to let you love it or ever be able to give it up. Watch out for this supermouth skullcap of bald. You don't have to adjust your ill-fitting pants to know everyone's looking down, and there's everything you could do about it and won't. The gum I pull from well-tractioned heels clings like a cinnamon-scented animal who knows what it doesn't know yet is worse than being stepped on. I'm sorry for still thinking of you, for wanting to clip your nails with left-handed scissors for no reason other than to be difficult, to repeat an old man's mantra in your ugly ears while you pretend not to be asleep. The bench is in the church. The bench is in the church. Virgil Moon is willing to see my bet and raise us both, straighten our legs and get our minds out of the soap dish, but the line at his window is too long. Tell me something dreamy and hopeful, why Virgil Moon's hair is in such disarray, why his face has fallen so. If there is a reason to clean out the sink, I should be notified. Virgil Moon, with your thick face, grab me by my ankles and make a wish. Play my heart like a terrible hot fiddle, replace me with catgut and see what I'll look like come Monday morning. Virgil Moon, you are over the top and smell like canned beans. Virgil Moon with the top down, making his travel plans to the museum and to the beach. Virgil Moon takes back the ring. Spit me out sideways somewhere near a track where dogs are supposed to race and place your bets against me. I will disappoint. I'm going to read another poem now called Junkyard Dinner. Nothing worth imagining can be seen there, hideous in rust, neglectful and fortunate, allowed to drive in, sold and given up, handed down, laid like the parts of doll porcelain, attached by threads of gentle blood, bodily ropes capable of hoisting deposits. Come back again tonight under the steering column. Pretend these needs are political to your nature. Tell anyone you know, changes are candles held upside down. They burn, and in their refusals, you can see their doing. Coming to bed, burning out, alighted upon, put out, understanding, wired with me. You can take the stairs, or else shiver under this metal canopy. Let me finger your ratted cushions once more, graze under the hood, a taste, the notion of tongue bitten through. And though it seems an act of silence, I'd say this is a man speaking now to me and for all purposes dead. If, as they say, flipping over a shark hypnotizes it, what happens then to cars driven into upside-down traffic patterns, into the artifice of this done-him-wrong shut mouth? This is a poem with no dogs in it. This is words held heavenly to your head. I spent some time in Chicago working at the Government Finance Officers Association, also known as the GFOA. And surprisingly, it inspired me to write a lot of poems while I was working there. And that's actually where Virgil Moon came from. The name was on a list of comptrollers. And there's another poem in the book called Darwin Light, which is another name that I found in a list at the Government Finance Officers Association. So this is a short poem that I wrote about working there. It's in Chicago. And if it's still there, it's downtown. The Government Finance Officers Association. Today there has been a prediction of snow, up to half a foot by midnight, and the air is full of this possibility. If this were a poem, by the end, the snow would begin to fall, noiselessly, blanketing even the busiest streets in this city with its cold wet. There would be details about sad people in tall office buildings, waiting for something to change, how they floss after lunch with thread and paper clips, how their tea bags slap the sides of their least favorite mugs, light one-night stands trying to deserve something more. How the whispered promise of pie or the cookies on the seventh floor can move them from their windows long enough to miss the sky becoming whiter and the wind picking up litter from the streets. After a lunch break too tedious to surreptitiously extend, city of maudlin-slashed villages, this could stick, I tell you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Erica Bernheim. She's reading from her new book, The Mimic Sea. Erica, I wanted to ask you about something that Robin Schiff said on the back of your book. Just one phrase I was interested in was, she was talking about how your work has a charged interior. And that really rings true to me. It feels to me, and I don't know if I'm right here, that a lot of your poems have to do with how things appear, the details of how things appear on the outside, but yet there's this underneath movement that we don't get to really hear about, but we feel in your poems. And I don't know if any of that rings true to you as the writer of the poem.
Oh, I think that's a great blurb and a beautiful, generous one that Robin wrote for the book. But I do think it's true. And I think to some extent it reflects the relationship that I had in mind when I was putting the book together, which is our human relationship to everything happening beneath the surface of the ocean and of the sea. And the title itself, The Mimic Sea, is something that P.T. Barnum came up with, and you can see that also in Robin's blurb. It was his term for the early version of an aquarium. And I happened upon that when I was reading about something else. And I think that's how a lot of poems kind of come to be anyhow. But I've also heard people say, and by people I mean scientists and people who know about these things, that we know more about outer space than we do about what's happening in the sea and the ocean and bodies of water around us. And I thought that was incredibly fascinating and disheartening and inspiring sort of at the same time. So I like to imagine all kinds of worlds under the surface. And so to think that that reflects into the poems is wonderful to hear. I'm mm-hmm. glad it's working.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that you'll read the title poem soon. But yeah, I was thinking of, you know, what's underneath in terms of relationships, and not so much the sea, but I know that's in there. And also I was thinking about, there seems to be something in the poems related to survival by appearance. Like, how does one survive by appearing a certain way? And what kind of deals are made for survival? I don't know if that relates to Under the Sea or if that relates to other things.
Well, there are certainly creatures under the sea as well that have to camouflage themselves. I've been studying and reading lately about the mimic octopus. And if I hadn't called this book The Mimic Sea, then maybe I would have tried to call it The Mimic Octopus instead. Mm-hmm. I think the silly saying, you know, fake it till you make it, or however that goes, I think that's also something that I had in mind. We have two choices, I think, really, when something terrible happens to us, and that is we either stop or we keep going, and we go on somehow. And terrible can mean anything, a bad day or something much more dire and drastic. I think appearance is incredibly important. I also love watching Project Runway, so I'm interested in lots of different kinds of appearances and mimicry as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think my favorite episodes of Project Runway are the ones in which the designers have to mimic something from the natural world. Mm-hmm. Using feathers to make a dress, or any number of challenges. I have very lowbrow television tastes, and I try and explain that away somehow. I have to think that it helps me somehow with my writing.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Absolutely. In fact, I was going to read The Mimic Sea next. This is The Mimic Sea, which, as I said, is after P.T. Barnum's name for the early aquarium. The insomniac is immediately identified, thanks to the prickly taste of her eyelids. Cats dream the same dreams as all other cats. Nemesis plants flourish beneath glass, best remembered for their vindictive natures, always restaking and dividing the nobility of their own last claims. "I already know how you are," he says, before having placed so much as a foot to the gear. "And I know what has happened. What we have in common is that we used to be our best selves in other people. We wore clothing made by people who cared nothing for us. You can't have too much blood. From the outside, this sea forces us to imagine it, and this allows the Fiji mermaid to stay with her keepers, silence and chastity. See this monkey's torso, sewn to the body of a fish, useful as typewriter ribbons, as strumming a guitar with claws better suited for butter sauce. Cramming our own bones down our own throats, sucking out the marrows with the abject intimacy we learn to mimic. When you hear the explosion from above, you will know it was me. When our mouths flash open beneath each other's, it is to scrape clean these barnacles of imaginary travel, signs that we might always be alone and happiest that way. Beckon to us, fabulons and tire swings, noisemakers and mufflers, a list of places I've stood outside unhappily, a weather-stripped barn, two glass walls crammed with bubbles, a tired sea, unaffected by my need to leave it in pieces, a fragment answering to desire, a note left behind is to be called nothing. The ambrotypes are, if you try, tongue traceable, their wishes masked under layers of glass, compassionate only to itself, protecting the finny miscreants trapped on both sides. Protection and its baggage will soon be parted. These are names to be recalled. Perch, starfish, anemones, periwinkles, sunfish, carp, sea ravens, flounders, rays, jellyfish, pickerel, sticklebacks, horned pout. Looking at them, you know they will not survive long. Imagine how many whales, albinoed, mistaken for porpoises, gave of their own best selves to stay with them in waters aerated but never changed. Buoyancy is its own best punishment. An excuse for need, for knowledge, prior, unwanted, and demonstrated daily, thanks to the addition of a hand organ and the seal who thinks he can play it well. It is true I have struggled. Think how long you can make the same mistake without trying. Notice how slowly water moves when it explodes around something so huge. Wait for it to stop. I, like many people, also enjoy watching the Olympics, and I wrote this poem after watching a Summer Olympics. And this is called "The Aged Gymnast Pauses Before the Vault." Who strains against the bars and the looseness of the grips? The new point system eludes us all, nor was time fair. The one thing I didn't want to be over is over when I am over my own head. Focus instead on my lips, from whose gashes emerge cyclones of locusts. I miss my 3D leotards, my beautiful white teeth performing the Yurchenko. Every turn a reminder of friendship games, so little given to daughters and fathers outside the apparatus each skipped. I felt like a goddess and aged like a homunculus. Whatever happened to the living people? The hugs we exchanged were handcuffs dropped around shoulders and rib cages dented. We were penalized for venturing outside our boundaries. Flipping on a 4-inch beam, be a predator, my coach told me. Carry your spine to your ears. Think of the papers waiting for you afterwards to sign. Begin with photos of yourself, then balances and checks bigger than sleeping bags. I wanted a fortress from my body. I disappeared in the smallest amounts. I threw myself. I landed badly, but no one saw. I went nowhere.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Erica Bernheim, and she's reading from her new book, The Mimic Sea, which was just published by 42 Miles Press. Erica, I wanted to ask you about the moments of voice that come into your poems. I really like how you have a lot of detail and a lot of great imagery, and then all of a sudden you'll have something like, what it was that it is true that I struggled or something like that, and how much power that voice has when it comes in after all this, almost like a cataloging of image. Can you talk about that, putting that together like that?
Thank you. I love details. I love images. I do love cataloging. I love reading catalogs. I like cataloging in my own poems. I think there are so many beautiful fish names floating around out there, no pun intended, that I didn't even know which ones to select almost for that poem. But I think that my tendency to return towards voice or towards what I see as a kind of narrative goes back to my always really wanting to have written fiction more. I always wanted to be a novelist or a writer of short stories. And I suppose announcing this on a radio show means it won't be a secret anymore, but I probably read more fiction than I do poetry. So to me, I guess having that voice creates a kind of narrative trajectory that I do want to be a part of my poems. Mm-hmm. And I think my main problem with fiction, for me, I mean, it's possible also that my fiction was terrible, but I think where I always ran into problems was trying to come up with a plot. I love details, and I loved, you know, having lines and ideas. But when it came down to plot and also dialogue, my characters always sounded like robots talking to each other. In fact, I have a poem in the collection, Dialogue for Robots, because anytime I tried, they just sounded so terrible. How are you? I am fine. You know, I couldn't write natural sounding dialogue. So yeah. I'm glad that voice is still coming through.
Oh, it's great.
Thank you.
It's great. Although I'm surprised about the fiction part because I think it's sometimes as a reader, it's hard to find the narrative line in your poems. And I was imagining that was on purpose. And because there's a lot of language moving around. And so I was wondering how you feel about language as artifice, you know, in a poem, or language as code, because you were talking about, we were talking a little bit about, well, the mimicry thing, how language as code figures into that, if it does at all.
I think it does in the types of poems that I want to write. I think essentially that Most of my poems are love poems. And I worry always when I'm writing that it's becoming tedious, or that I think many poets worry that we're writing the same poem over and over again. And so for me, switching the language or switching what I want to do halfway through is one way that I try and keep it somehow different from the other poem. And sometimes there is something different happening in my mind, but I think a lot of times we work through whatever we're thinking about through poems and through writing about it. It doesn't always help, but I suppose if someone says, well, that's a really great poem, then you can think, well, I might have been unhappy, but look, I've written a wonderful poem as a result. So for me, it's definitely a kind of practical issue, I think.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense to me now, because there's so much movement in your poems and a lot of surprise. So that makes sense.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you read some more?
Of course. I'm going to read the first poem in the collection, which is called Moon Rats. And I didn't really picture it as the first poem, but my editor, David Dodd Lee, did, and I trust him. So I'm going to read Moon Rats. Anyone can tell you I'm bad news, can see the reflections of those fireworks in the shadows of different pavements. True, words were never spoken. The problem is, I knew you back when your hands were under 100, and even then it was hard to keep up. How do you measure something determined to pass over the world? You walk like reincarnation, each movement unbearably tedious, inexplicable, predictable, staving off yourself with both hands. I would placate you in a blessed sack for the rest of your days, associate yourself with fire, with the yellow and red cross of St. Andrew, and what they'll find digging up that street, bones slow and heavy. Explain to me disappearance, the vanishing of fingernails after a long bath, something I could pin my wishes upon other than parfait's glycerine treats, or octopus, old turf, turning white with sleep, devouring my arms to protect you. Anymore, my heart resembles the adhesive of a child, easily passed off as something else, somewhere buried under the framework of a phony construction site. All I can thank you for is expediency, renting and paying the actors to watch over you until morning, losing your last few teeth and reading on. Like, for instance, sitting across from you with nothing to say. I have forgotten how it means to be so tired. It's good to notice, like naturalness in ballroom dancing, a spin to the right, men with names like Nick Cotton and the women's heads, to see that angle while still alive, only seeming broken. You need not be moving to love this much speed, a chemical tang of lust. It's about execution. Waltz, tango, quick step, slow foxtrot. Nick Cotton gets rid of his tails. A pretend swoon at the end, the woman is almost to the floor. My grandmother cries out, kiss her. I am planting morning glories at night. I can regenerate anything but this, nothing from nothing, more nothing than nothing. But these are high holy days without you, something curling under the doorways like smoke. No, don't call it that. Call it dolore, like God, when he cared enough to be vengeful and watch the effort of closing your lids over the globes of your downturned eyes, the vision so crisp and mistaken. Elements. Hello, neighbor. I think nothing of leaning into your photoed face, sad darling. I've got rights, and I should look into them.
You know what, you know, just listening to that poem and hearing the word execution, that word shows up a lot in your book. And every yes. time I came upon it, I'm like, what is going on? And because sometimes it's about death, and sometimes it's about how things are done. And there's also a lot of blood and shooting in your book.
Yes.
I was kind of wondering.
I know. And, you know, it's ironic. But I'm probably one of the most squeamish people you could ever meet. I can't even watch scary movies. Zombies, I can do maybe, but mm-hmm. I am. I am afraid, and I mean, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I am afraid that one day a student will get really angry with me and will shoot me. And I hear about these terrible shootings, and it's almost always a creative writing student, which makes me very uncomfortable in a sort of egotistical way. Mm-hmm. And so a dear friend of mine said, well, if it's something you're so scared about, maybe you should start writing poems about it. And so mm-hmm. there are two poems in the book, The One Who Shot Me and then The One Who Shot Me Next. Mm-hmm. And I've been trying to work on a longer series of those, but I think even just maybe writing those two made me feel a little bit better.
Okay. Okay, that helps shed some light on it. But I was wondering what's going on. Okay, I don't know if you want to read either of those. I mean,
sure, okay. I would be glad to. Okay, The One Who Shot Me was reading aloud before it happened. I dreamt I was a controversy. Like a pool party to watch the world burn, we were evacuated on a Tuesday. Saved on Friday by oysters, snappers, groupers, but no blowfly. She stays behind. The antidote was worse than knowing I wanted this. Violence, you six-shot deal. I remember the oven you purchased. Name one. I forget trying to remember to clean it. Hat, you have become a hand. Bullet, I thought you knew me better than that. Hand, I mistook you for a stop sign. And this is called The One Who Shot Me Next. Didn't wear sunglasses. He looked good in whatever he wore, but he wasn't wearing yellow. He wasn't at the park. He wasn't at the mall. I heard he was at the movies. It was true. He was watching the scene when access to parking spaces becomes less likely than thinking about it. Baroque, coded, straining, and vengeful, your best-kept secrets murmur beneath a bridge under a wall. Patrons dream of daydreams of bedbugs and haze, yet we will never agree on how it happened. And the last poem that I'm going to read is called Car Rolls Off Clay-Wade Bailey Bridge, which is a bridge in Cincinnati. And what of the driver trapped between metal and more metal, metal and water, water and time? A concrete island, a wish for loosening, a confrontation with his mother 19 years ago, too close to tell anybody, now bored by tears in this condition of you, abandoned, outside of town, it comes to us quickly northbound. Think of it as a loop bound to a tunnel, cautioning an electric cathedral, weakness, a hip bone resting against what you call a tree seen near water. Imagine yourself named. Listen to yourself shutting both up and down. Imagine yourself remembering daylight savings for once, only better. Your only knowledge is one of desire, and now it can be just. You forget to breathe, and this, look, moving, this does it for you. Icicle lights, fountain gates, pressurized air locks more than enough you into you. A shrapneled soldier who wants only to go back is worth that trouble. Think of the gun, oblique and finite, rushing in as though water could change to pears and honey. If it's me you're here for, say so. Cincinnati, listen, if you were beautiful, there'd be no need for this.
The poetry of Erica Bernheim. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.